interceptor, but the balloon really didn't look that much like the warhead. So it wasn't. That was another reason why this test was less than realistic. Now, in fairness to the Pentagon, they say they want to, you know, walk before they run and do and test against very simple countermeasures to begin with before they get more sophisticated. But this is another asterisk next to it.
So there's not one but two here.
There's several asterisks.
can you give us another?
The fact that they're only shooting against one warhead, as in an enemy not only wouldn't be so kind as to put a beacon on their warhead, but they also would probably fire more than one, especially if we had some defenses. So, but they're going to get to this down the road, they say. But consumers should beware, buyers should beware that they're not there yet and that these tests are not exactly real-world exercises.
Well, and what comes next in the testing schedule? When do we see another one of these exercises?
Well, they say they're going to do about 10 a year.
10 a year?
Yeah, something like that. So we're going to see them with a lot of rapidity.
And at what point will we see a test that shows us whether this stuff can really work or not?
Good question. As I say, they're not building this radar, which they would need to build to get rid of the beacon. So who knows when we're going to see the first beaconless test. So it's going to take a while. It's going to take a long while, and you know, it's going to take a lot of resources, and that's one of the key questions about this issue. How much is this going to cost? And what are you not going to be able to buy, either in the military or somewhere else in the government, as a result of building this?
Well, since they're talking about a system that would cost $100 to $200, maybe $300 billion, it would be nice, at least, if they level with us about the asterisk.
That's a fair statement.
Well, thank you, John Donnelly of Defense Week, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now we turn to Walter Clemens, a professor of political science at Boston University. The Bush administration has talked about walking out on the Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty, which was ratified in 1972, but it may not be so easy for Bush to pull the U.S. out of it. Professor, can you tell us about this treaty and why the U.S. wants out of it?
Well, the Bush administration wants out of it in order to get a free hand to build a national missile defense system. My argument is that the Senate, or in fact both houses of Congress, have the right to challenge the president's ability to cancel a treaty. I wrote an article, it was in the Washington Post, on whether the president may break a treaty without Congress. And my answer, after looking at something like 50 precedents since 1798, is that usually, to break a treaty, both the Congress and the President have played a role. In fact, our very first treaty, it was an alliance with France, was broken by Congress, by both houses of Congress, passing an act. So there have been many cases where both the executive and the legislature have played a role in canceling a treaty. One time when the president tried to break a treaty alone was when Jimmy Carter tried to abrogate our alliance with Taiwan in the late 1970s. And at that time, 16 members of Congress sued Jimmy Carter, and the district court, that was the first court to hear the case, said that the president simply may not abrogate a treaty all alone.
And did it go up higher than that? Did it go to the Supreme Court?
Yes. Barry Goldwater led this challenge to Carter, and it went up to an appeals court. The appeals court said, well, the Constitution gives the president the right to take the lead in foreign policy, and so he should have a free hand.
Now, when
Goldwater took it to the Supreme Court, And the Supreme Court said this issue is simply so political that we can't rule on it. But one of the justices...
It's not like the Supreme Court we have these days.
Well, that's true. One of the justices, Powell, agreed with the majority that they shouldn't rule on it. But he said the reason was that Congress has not taken a stand explicitly claiming its right to have a role in terminating a treaty. And so I think that's what Congress or the Senate should do right now, is to claim a role in abrogating a treaty so that the White House may not do this alone.
Now, the issue, of course, is that the ABM Treaty of 1972 put severe limits on how you can test and deploy missile defenses. It allows for some, but it's very tightly restricted, correct?
Well, that's correct. And President Clinton actually worked out a few revisions of the treaty with Russia that would permit the United States to carry to build defenses that would probably stop, or that might stop, medium-range missiles, not intercontinental missiles of the kind that would come all the way from Russia to the United States. And Clinton was under great pressure from the Republican Congress to do this. And he even threatened that if the Russians did not make more concessions, he might abrogate the treaty. But he was saved from that kind of a confrontation by the fact that the missile tests that were conducted in his time didn't work very well, and so there was no point in really going ahead with abrogating the treaty.
Now, isn't there a clause in the treaty that permits one side or the other to withdraw after giving 6 months' notice? Can't Bush just do that?
Well, it's certainly true that the treaty gives each side the right to pull out of the treaty if extraordinary events occur that would jeopardize its sovereign interests. And so Bush could point to that, but in fact, the Bush administration has warned U.S. embassies abroad that we will violate the treaty within a few months. They sent out messages to American embassies across the world in July saying that. Well, a few months is not 6 months. And so the Bush administration has such disdain for international law and this particular treaty that it seemed like they're willing to violate it by not even giving the Russians the proper notice.
Now, why?
And what extraordinary events have occurred? None. The only thing that's really threatening that would be a point to building the defense system is from North Korea. And the Bush administration has, instead of talking with North Korea, has denounced the North Koreans as not worth talking to. And so, if anything, of course, that magnifies the kind of threat that the North Koreans might pose to the United States at some point.
Now, why wouldn't the Bush administration, if it wants to do this within couple months, not wait 6 months? Can you give me a brief answer to that? Why rush ahead?
There's no good reason to do so. In fact, it's crazy because our technology is nowhere close, as your previous interviewer pointed out, our technology is nowhere close to being ready to do the job that it's supposed to do.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. Let me thank you, Professor Walter Clements at Boston University. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
You're listening to The David Korn Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. We have to take a short break, but stay tuned because coming up, we'll be talking about how Americans may be missing out when it comes to vacation time. And if you do manage to get some time away, well, you might not be so safe if you're spending your vacation on a beach. I'm David Korn, and we'll be back in just a moment. Washington turns into a ghost town in the summer. Members of Congress head home, and President Bush is at his ranch for a month-long vacation, the longest vacation taken by a president in 32 years. But Americans in general get less vacation time than workers anywhere else in the world. Peter Berg is an expert on labor practices in the U.S. and in Europe, and a research associate at the Economics Policy Institute in Washington. He joins us to tell us just how hard we Americans have it. Welcome, Peter.
Hello.
Well, so tell us, what's the first thing that comes into your mind when you hear that President Bush is taking a month off?
Well, I was thinking about how many people in this country have to work usually a year or 6 months at least before they can get a week's vacation or two. So I thought it was really something to have a nice job like president where you can get a month off after a few months of in office.
That's a pretty good benefit, isn't it?
Yes.
What's the vacation situation for most Americans these days?
Well, it's interesting, in this country there really is no guarantee that you as a worker will get a paid vacation. It's really up to the employer if you get paid vacation or not, or if you work under a union contract, what's in the contract. So there are many people in this country who only have access to unpaid vacation. But usually people get about a week or 2 weeks of vacation.
Do you have any statistics on that, the average vacation length for the average worker?
I don't have any statistics, really, but usually if you look across contracts, and I've looked at a number of contracts, you find that with many people in different ends of the people working in different jobs, you probably get a vacation around 2 weeks. People in lower-paying jobs with less vacation, and white-collar workers in higher-paying jobs with more.
Now, there are laws that limit the hours in the work week and that give unpaid maternity and paternity leave to certain workers, correct?
That's right. There's a Family Medical Leave
right.
Act that people can take.
But nothing on the books anywhere, not in any state, about vacation time?
Well, there's no legal guarantees. This is something that's really considered a benefit by the part of the employer. And it's not much different in Europe either, where a lot of these things are won through collective bargaining or through agreements between unions and employers.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. There are no laws in Europe that give people the right to vacation, but yet tell us about what vacations they do get.
Well, sometimes it varies by country, but by and large, with greater coverage of contracts in Europe, sometimes 70 to 80% of people working under contract, in contrast to the U.S., vacations usually run about 5 to 6 weeks.
5 to 6 weeks?
That's right, 30 days.
I'm out of here.
I know. I mean, it's a very different model. And most people in Europe, relative to the U.S., have a preference for working shorter hours. There have been laws passed that reduce the work week in Europe so that, you know, officially now France has passed a law that they have a 35-hour work week. And in Germany, the work week has been brought down through negotiations between unions and employers' associations to 35, 36, or 38 hours. So you see working hour reduction. At the same time, vacation has been maintained at 5 to 6 weeks.
So what does that say for the number of days or hours an American worker spends working versus what a European does?
Well, the U.S. works the highest hours of any country in the world. People work more hours in the U.S., even more than in Japan. So the U.S. has a preference for working more, but I think one of the reasons for that is that we've seen, in certainly in some occupations, in the low end of the income distribution, declining real wages. And therefore, people are working more hours to maintain a standard of living.
So if we're working harder here, does that reflect in our standard of living? Are things better here on average than they are in Norway?
Well, it really depends, I mean, in how you measure that. Certainly, there are people would say, in terms of money, the U.S. has a very high standard of living. But if you look at other aspects of quality of life, work and family balance, time, ability to spend time with your family and time at work, people would say the Europeans have a much better balance in that sense because they have more time off from work.
Hmm. And what are the trends, both here and in Europe? Is a trend, as you noted, it seems to be in Europe, the trend is to work less. Are we working more and more each year here, or is it leveling off at all?
I think it's been pretty steady recently here in the United States. The trend in Europe clearly is to reduce hours, but I think the pressure is building in the United States to find ways that people can work fewer hours, reduce, go less than full-time. And a lot of talk about work-family balance, a lot of talk about people feeling a time squeeze and a time crunch, and what we haven't seen is this translated yet into legislation or into real big changes at the workplace. What we see is the United States, some companies have taken initiative in this area and others haven't.
Now,
so it really depends on the employer you work for.
You're at his or her mercy, is what you're saying,
you
in terms of vacation.
And sometimes employers are more willing to make accommodations for you, and sometimes they're not. And the thing that affects that is, in the United States, the tight labor market. Employees now, because of their position and their skills, are sometimes in a position to ask for different working arrangements. I want to go to part-time. And if they want to keep you, they may be willing to accommodate you.
Now, I've always thought that it'd be quite popular for a politician to come forward and say, vote for me, and I'll give you more time off. You want to, and support a measure that would give a federal benefit to a vacation, 1 week, 2 week, whatever. If you work full-time for an employer, you have a right to a vacation. But yet, that has not ever appeared on the political radar, as far as I can tell. And when I've mentioned it to a few friends who are in the political game, they kind of look at me like I'm nuts. Why is that? Not why I'm nuts, but why does this not really take hold?
Well, I think it would resonate with people, but we also have a tradition of not putting a lot of mandates on businesses, and it's probably considered that we aren't going to mandate to businesses how they run their business. Businesses would oppose that, I think, to a great degree.
But we tell them what the minimum wage is. We tell them how many hours you have, you can work a week before you pay overtime. We tell them all sorts of health and safety regulations, and this is a pretty basic matter.
Yeah, well, in that sense, it is a basic matter, but you have to look at the trade-offs of saying you must then give people time off from work. And those companies that are only doing unpaid leave or small businesses, I think, would oppose that fiercely, because that is paid time off that they now must give their employees. Whereas large employers probably are giving this benefit already, and therefore it would have little impact on them. So I think the small business lobby is where you'd have the biggest trouble.
Well, yes, but they have some clout. But they don't always win their fights on Capitol Hill. And I still have been surprised that particularly the Democratic Party, which is willing to go up against this lobby on minimum wage and other matters, has never really broached this issue. It seems to be almost untouchable.
Yes, well, I would agree with you. I don't see any evidence of it. And it seems to me that it's a good area to pursue. Maybe we should shout louder.
We don't want to hurt our engineer in the booth there. This week there was also news in terms of productivity of the American worker. News that productivity had gone up a great deal, correct?
That's correct.
Now, that means that employers are getting more out of their worker per hour, correct?
That's correct.
People are working more efficiently.
That's correct.
Now, who gains from that? If workers are working more productively, should they see more in terms of time off? Should they have to work less like they do in France? Or should they get more vacation time? Should they get higher pay? Does any of this come back to the people doing the work?
Well, what we should, theoretically, they should see it in terms of higher pay. If workers are more productive, they should get higher wages. But we know that that doesn't always work together, since over the 90s, productivity grew at a much faster rate than real wage growth grew. So what you have is that workers, in order to capture some of those gains, either need bargaining power to do it in pushing up their wages, or leverage in some form through the labor market. And even tight labor markets eventually led to some increases, but it didn't really match productivity in every case. So workers should see higher wages, but a lot of things driving these numbers is when you have layoffs and you reduce the number of people in the labor force, productivity is going to go up. So there's an element of numbers here, and also an element of people are just being more productive with the technology that they're using and the work organization that they're part of.
So, Peter, tell us about you. Will you be taking a vacation this year? How much time do you get off?
Well, as a professor, I get a lot of flexibility, but I'm actually only going to take a week's vacation. So I've had a very difficult and busy year.
Well, Peter Berg, Research Associate at the Economic Policy Institute, thank you so much. I hope next year is easier.
Thank you.
Okay, so Americans have less vacation time than other folks, but at least we've got some nice beaches to go to when we do get a break, right? Wrong. A report just released by the Natural Resources Defense Council shows that beach closings and advisories in the U.S. skyrocketed to over 11,000 last year. That's twice as many as in 1999. To help us understand what's going on here, we're joined by Sarah Chasis in New York. She's the director of the NRDC's Coastal and Water Program. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell me, if Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello held a beach party these days, would they be drowning in bacteria and God knows what else?
It depends where they swim. What we see is that there's some beaches that are cleaner than others and some that do a better job of monitoring and alerting the public. As you mentioned, the number of beach closings and advisories skyrocketed last year as compared to the previous year, and we found there were two principal causes for this. One, that there was more rain in some parts of the country, the Northeast, some of the Great Lakes states. And, you know, the more rain there is, the more pollution that gets into the water.
Why is that?
Because the rain runs off the land, picks up pollution on the land, and then brings it into the Great Lakes, the oceans, the bays. So that's one reason there were some increases. The other reason, and probably the more important reason, was that states and localities have increased their monitoring and reporting. And what we're finding is that the more you look for pollution, that is, the more monitoring there is, the more you find. So that's the good news is there is more monitoring, and the public is being told when there's pollution. More and more. But the bad news is that pollution appears to be a persistent problem at many U.S. beaches.
So when I went swimming at the ocean as a kid and we didn't have these advisories, it's not that the water was necessarily cleaner, it's just we didn't know.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is a form of pollution that you can't see but with the naked eye.
I mean, tell us, what type of pollution are we talking about? I mean, we had the medical waste thing a few years ago, and people can see that. You can see when there's junk in the water, but that's not what you have in mind here, is it?
Exactly. The principal cause of these closings and advisories is the fact that there are elevated, higher levels of bacteria in the water, levels that exceed the health standards. And that's an indication that there is pollution. Mainly, we're talking about sewage pollution and polluted stormwater. Those are the two principal known sources. And this pollution contains disease-causing organisms that can make people sick. And the most common illnesses are gastroenteritis, symptoms of which can be diarrhea, vomiting, fever, chills, eye and ear infections, skin rashes, upper respiratory illness, and even more serious things such as hepatitis, although that's much, much rarer. So this is the major concern, and the major point of monitoring is because people can't tell just by looking, you need states, local governments to be vigilant in checking the water quality.
So what you're telling is that we're swimming in our own you-know-what.
Right.
That's a happy thought as we get ready to go to the beach this weekend.
Well, look, it's not true of many, many beaches.
Right.
And the good news is if the waters are being monitored and the beaches are open, you know they're clean. If they're being monitored and they're closed, then you're being protected. So,
what's the percentage of beaches that are monitored?
Well, that's a
how
good,
do we know?
That's a good question. I mean, the way you know, it varies from state to state. Some states do a more comprehensive job than others. And I'd like to refer people to our website.
Go ahead.
It's www.nrdc.org, because we have information about over 2,000 beaches. They're principally ocean and bay beaches and Great Lakes beaches. We haven't had the resources to do the more of the inland rivers and lakes. But that information will give you some indication of, you know, is your beach monitored, how frequently, what kind of standards are used, were there closings last year. So that's one way to find out. Another is check with your local health department. Now, there's some typical or generalities, you might say. Beaches, you know, open ocean tends to be a lot cleaner than bays and semi-enclosed water bodies. The further you are from development, you know, the safer, obviously. Watch out if there are storm drains on the beach. There's some communities where they funnel the storm water right onto the beach, and into the near shore waters, and that can be a problem, particularly after a heavy rainfall. Swimming in water after a heavy rain can be problematic for the reason I stated earlier. You know, the heavier the rain brings the pollution from land into the water.
Now, can you give us generalities which states might have the best beaches or the worst beaches or the best monitoring or the worst monitoring?
There are 11 states that have fairly comprehensive monitoring and public notification programs. And
that's 11 out of 50.
Well, it's 11 actually out of 32 states and territories. We didn't rate inland states except those on the Great Lakes.
Kansas, for instance. You don't worry about beaches in Kansas.
Well, we do, but we just don't have the resources to monitor, to get you know, the information, monitor all those states.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll run through. California has a very comprehensive system. It was a state law that was enacted a couple of years ago. It requires monitoring at all beaches that are used by 50,000 people or more on an annual basis, and beaches that have storm drains or are near storm drains. If they've got to issue an advisory or closing whenever there's an exceedance, they have to test with the EPA standard as well as others. So that's a very comprehensive system. And
give us an example of a state that's not doing well.
Oregon and Louisiana are on our list of beach bums. And beach bums are states that don't have regular monitoring and public notification programs.
And I'm heading up to Massachusetts later in the summer. Should I be worried?
Massachusetts does a pretty good job. They're one of the states that has a pretty comprehensive program. They did enact a law last year, which is supposed to go into effect this year, which requires weekly monitoring, posting of signs, use of a good standard. Apparently, though, it depends on the state legislature appropriating money, and they haven't done that. So Massachusetts needs to take that next step, but they've got a reasonably good process. And
I think we have to leave it at that, but let me just ask you, are you hitting the beach this summer?
I am definitely hitting the beach this summer. I love the ocean.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
That's Sarah Chases in New York. She's the director of the NRDC's Coastal and Water Program. And I'm sad to say that's all the time we have. Senior producers for The David Korn Show are Stacey Bond and David Raven. Our associate producer is Emily Weintraub. Special thanks go to Brian Gibbons, Catherine Lewis, Steve Yasko, and the Pacifica News Network staff. Our engineer is John O'Leary. Let us know what you think. You can reach us by email at cornshow@pacifica.com.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Every Wednesday at 9 p.m., you won't want to miss Asia Pacific Forum, the only place you'll hear about grassroots Asian politics, culture, art, and the Asian spirit. Only on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio.
Many others in a moment's time sacrifice illuminated light. Many others forgot their own name, but I'm about to use it. Many others.
Asia Pacific Forum every Wednesdays at 9 p.m. only on 99.5 FM.
Now we choose the same means of it, they're trading our living hours for shelter.
It's 1:30. You're listening to WBAI. Coming up next, live from LoJack City, Radio Free Aaron.
even take you to the house. Happy to come.
Welcome to Radio Free Erin on a rainy day here in New York City. Well, I have a feeling this is going to be one of those shows you might want to tape. Long before there was single name people such as Cher and Madonna, there was, long before that, well, not too long because she's listening right now, Odetta.
And I had the pleasure of meeting Odetta at a fundraiser for Bernard White over at the Chelsea Pier. And there she sang a song that our audience would be familiar with, The Foggy Dew. So when she came off the stage, somebody introduced me to her. And I said, where did you get that song? And how did you, you know, you come about it? And she said, I learned it from the Clancy Brothers. And I learned a lot of history of Ireland from Paul Robeson. So I said, stop right there. Hold those stories. We're going to get you on the show. We're going to play some of your music, and we'll get into some of the songs that you do sing on the album. So Odetta will be a guest in a very short while, and I wanted to thank Rashida Uptown on 127th Street there, who gave me four of her albums that we'll be taking songs off and playing.
I think she loaned them to you, John.
Let me
just say something. As an old Odetta fan, I don't think anybody gives those albums. I had some of those albums many years ago, and they are long out of print. Unfortunately, my copies got stolen. So nobody gives those up lightly.
And we'll have on Nolik in a little while. And, of course, the most important news to come out of Ireland now at the moment, forget about decommissioning, forget about everything, Kerry won in football today. And that's all Nolik wanted to talk about, but he'll be giving us an update on that. And then this is a very unusual dateline. We'll be heading up to the Bronx to speak with Ed Maloney. And he'll be telling about the Provisional IRA's new phase of the struggle. And it'll be called, as we are christening it here, the Concrete Retreat.
Yeah, this was the... Jerry Adams was right. He said this was historic. It was historic because the IRA, for the first time in its entire history, or the history of the Fenian movement that came before it, said it will put its arms irretrievably beyond use. And we're talking with Ed about what that means, but just very quickly, it means that the IRA and its front, Sinn Féin, have made their peace with British administration in Ireland, with the southern government. There is no going back from this. This means the end of any vague pretense that they are any sort of revolutionary movement, that they're out to overthrow British rule in Ireland. They have finally and irretrievably given all that up when they said this week that they will put their arms irretrievably beyond use. A wonderful phrase, and we'll be talking to Ed about that.
And also, I'd like to thank Bob Fast, who does a show here. I know a lot of people are sleeping at that hour, but Friday morning from 12 to 3:30 is giving me the privilege of being up there and doing the show. And I have to say, Bob's not being treated all the best, being called by one engineer a fossil. I don't think that's how we should treat the station elders. But there was an incident that happened. Bob is working with an African-American kid who's doing a documentary on Larry Davis. And the week before when I was on, he was up here filming Bob talking about Larry Davis, and there was no problems. The crew left. It was a niece of Larry Davis is working with this young kid that was doing the documentary, and he's hoping to have it on Showtime. But lo and behold, Bob, myself, and the two people came up on Thursday night, and we were told by security that there could be no filming here at the station. So I inquired why not. I mean, Radio Free Erin's been on the air almost 20 years, and we've had almost every television crew possible to give publicity to the station, between the BBC, RTE, New York One, NBC, all the stations at one time or another, if there was a crisis going on in Ireland, would come up here and film, and we never had a problem. So security asked the young African-American, did he have any sort of business card? Now, I don't know if he did or not. He was fumbling through his wallet looking for something. And then word came back in, talked to management, that he would have been allowed to film, but he would have to call management the following morning and receive permission to air it or get a release form signed by management. But by the time we got to that point, Bob had started the show, and the kid couldn't do the interview. So Bob said, you don't need a release form for me. You can come out to my house. But this is just all part of the new changes that are going on up here at the station, where now we have to go through some process to get the station publicity.
Well, I loved listening to David Rothenberg every Saturday morning. It's one of the treats of my week, not just my day, my week. I was really downer, really sad to hear David say this morning that he doesn't know how long he's going to be here, and that in fact he thinks it's just a matter of time before he's either taken off the air or just can't take it anymore. And that's, you know, when the likes of David Rothenberg says, I may not be able to be here much longer. You know, there's something amiss.
Well, David probably has one of the best one-liners I've heard so far. He said he felt like Anne Frank in the studio here, and he was expecting Nazi stormtroopers to come marching into the studio. And just another little update, anybody reading the Daily News, a good friend of Radio Free Erin's, Bob Lederer and Kathy Davis were, and I won't use the euphemism, were taking off the air. They were fired this week from their show on Tuesday, Health Watch. Bob Lederer, who used to cover the St. Patrick's Day Parade for Radio Free Erin and the ILGO demonstrations from Fifth Avenue, and he was a valuable resource that he was down there. He's a part of the gay community. He gave his great insight into what was going on. His voice has been silenced around here. And also, there's a possibility that our good friend Amy Goodman's voice might be silenced. I was going to read out the memo that was sent to Bob Lederer, but we don't have that much time. But this was another letter that was put up and sent out to a lot of people. And like Gary Noll, I did investigation. I did 2,000 hours of research, and I spoke to one side. I spoke to Amy, I spoke to Eileen Sutton, and Anthony Sloan. But this is what happened here during the week to Amy Goodman, who's the producer of Democracy Now! It said, sources say that minutes before airtime this morning and without explanation, intern general manager Yatrice Lead once again threw Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Out of the master broadcast studio and into WBAI Studio 3, a small, substandard broadcast space not suited for a national program. Lead last moved the show into Studio 3 this past May when Democracy Now! Was taken off the air 3 weeks in New York. Technically, challenges abound. Studio 3 cannot accommodate multiple phone guests, and the clock, a critical component of a professional radio production, has been broken for months. The clock in Studio 3 is, in fact, covered by gold foil, which I'll add is still covered by gold foil. When Goodman commented on the clock to Lead, sources said Lead sarcastically told Goodman to go buy one. National Program Director Stephen Yasko, a staunch promoter of Pacifica's professionalism, also happened to be at WBAI this morning when Democracy staff, now staff, was racing to prepare. Goodman asked Yasko for a clock, and he then brought one in without numbers on it. Other morning producers laughed as they watched Goodman and her staff hurrying to prepare in Studio 3 for a complicated show. Sources said that they were mocked by saying, watch them run, watch them run. It goes on and on about it, but a latest update on that, downstairs when we signed in today to LoJack City, because now they want us to be monitored up here at the station, there was a note, and here's what the note said downstairs at security. Robert Knight and Eddie Soto are not allowed on site. Amy Goodman, Chris Abrams, and Brad Simpson are not allowed on site until Monday morning. So that means Democracy Now! Cannot do any pre-organizing or pre-taping of their shows here at WBAI.
Now, everybody knows who Amy Goodman is, and probably many people know who Robert Knight is, but who are the other people there?
Well, Eddie Soto was an engineer here, and I don't know why he's on this list. I haven't heard anything about him, but Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson are producers of Democracy Now!, so that's a note that's downstairs. But right now we'll go and make some announcements. We want to say, once again, Irish Night will be August 25th, and Radio Free Erin will be bringing about 40 of our zany listeners out to Irish Night. And it's unfortunate that Black 47 is not playing. The bands that will be playing are Andy Cooney, the Highland Rovers, and the McCabes. It's very ironic. Shea Stadium people sent me talking points about the Mets. I went to my first Met game at the Polo Ground, but
that's two of us, John.
Yeah, but it's funny, and I tried to explain to him, we are Met fans. We give the score out only when the Mets are winning on Radio Free Erin. So at the end of the show,
I remember that going to the Polo Grounds when the Giants came in to see Willie Mays play the Mets and had to sit behind a post in the old Polo Grounds, but it was worth it.
And it says, enjoy.
Unfortunately, the Mets lost, but that's nothing new.
That's usual. Enjoy pregame entertainment with Irish culture. It says here, part of the international weekend, the Mets celebration of New York's cultural diversity. It'll be Irish Night. It'll be on the 25th at 7:10 p.m. A lot of us will be leaving from Rocky Sullivan's. We'll be taking a ferry over from 34th Street. The boat leaves from there and heads over to Shea Stadium. It's a wonderful night out. We'll be giving tickets away at the end of the show when we open up the phone line. So keep that in mind. Irish Night, August 25th, and if we can get the Met game, and we'll be giving the scores only if they're winning.
Okay. I want to give a shout-out to my father, who was an unrepentant Fenian out there on Wednesday in the hot sun. He was protesting for a certain radio station who he's been a supporter member since 1962. And so he's out there listening to the show. I want to tell Dad I hope he feels better. Also, Michael Franti and Spearhead. He, John, the CD we played a couple weeks ago, and he's also been on Democracy Now a few times. He is going to be playing at Wetlands. That's this Tuesday, August 14th at 8 p.m. Wetlands is closing, so this is probably going to be the last show of Michael Franti down there. And a couple more musical notes coming up. The Saw Doctors, Wednesday, August 22nd, is going to be in Seabright, New Jersey, Trade Winds. And also there's... every Tuesday night down at the World Trade Center is Celtic Night or Celtic Night. And coming up August 14th, it's going to be Susan McEwen and Johnny Cunningham and also the band Lunasa. So that's Tuesdays at 6 p.m. at Center Stage Series, Twin Towers, World Trade Center. That's Church and Day Street. So every Tuesday at 6 p.m., free Celtic concert.
That's amazing. You want to just repeat that? Susan McEwen.
Susan McEwen, Johnny Cunningham, and oh, that's actually August 14th, and the 28th is going to be Lunasa. So that's Tuesday nights if you want to hear some great free Celtic music.
Amazing.
World Trade Center. And last week it was, or a couple weeks ago it was Solis. So.
And right now we're going to go to Odetta and then Nolik, and then we'll play another Odetta song and go to the woman herself. Yes.
I don't want a bald-headed woman. Oh, she to me, Lord, Lord, oh, she to me. I don't want a bald-headed woman. Oh, she to me, Lord, Lord, no, she to me. I don't want no sugar in my coffee. It makes me mean, Lord. It make me mean, Lord, Lord, well, it make me mean. I got a bulldog, it weighs 500 in my backyard, Lord, Lord, in my backyard. When he barks, he roars like thunder. When you see my long-haired woman, you bow your head, Lord, Lord, you better bow your head. When you see my long-haired woman, oh, bow your head, Lord, Lord, you better bow your head. I don't want no. She to me, Lord, Lord, oh, she to me. I don't want no bald-headed woman. Oh, she to me, Lord, Lord, no, she to me. Hold that line.
And that was Odetta singing Bald-Headed Women and... Woman. And now we'll head over to Galway. And we'll get the... I guess, Nolik, we're going to have to start with the sports because that seems to be the most important thing going on there at the moment.
Well, there are always priorities and we have to pick our news stories, don't we, John? Good news for the Kerry people is that they won the replay against Dublin and Turles. We nearly had a national crisis during the week because all the Dublin got lost going to Turles last Saturday and they said they should bring them back to Croke Park. They never think that the Kerry people and the Cork people and the Galway people have to go to Croke Park every month, but never mind, that's what they call Metropolis ISIS or whatever. The other match is on at the moment, Westmeath and Meath. Meath leading at the moment, but one Meath man put off. Kerry had to play with 14 men in the second half too, and we'll talk about the technicalities of that for the next week while the world is in crisis. The other one I want to mention before getting on to the strictly political is, of course, that the Gateway organisation, computer company, is pulling out of both Britain and Ireland. There's serious well, economic crisis in North County Dublin, something like 900 jobs on the line up there, and it's a very tough and emotional period for the people in that particular area that came in 1993, were good employers and have been pretty well established in some of the long-term unemployed communities in North County Dublin. But interestingly enough, talking to people at the gate coming out when the bad news came last week, several of them seemed to look at it as a challenge and seemed to think that they would get redeployment within the high-tech industry, which is still booming in Ireland, despite the reverberations coming from North America and other backward economies. Coming on to the other things, of course, the other big news today has been the institutions which have been brought down again by the British Secretary. And without going into the technicalities of this, you know that the requirements of the new Stormont are that there be power sharing, that both communities must have brought community support. The second requirement was, of course, that Trimble had pulled out as First Minister, and therefore he's gone on holidays for a fortnight, by the way, which means he expected this anyway. But that meant, in fact, that the thing would have collapsed altogether if the Secretary of State hadn't done this technical thing of postponing it for a day and then restoring it this evening, which means that the Crown Colony Governor carries on for another 6 weeks while they haggle over decommissioning and policing and equality and all the other. The British are always anxious for talks about talks. Now, Sinn Féin have taken this on the chin. They've taken it as being very insulting to their position, because they said, we recognise Stormont, we went into Stormont, we recognise British presence in the short term, we recognise partition, and now you're bending to the unionists again. You did it last year with Mr. Mandelson, this year you're doing it with the new man, Mr. Reid from Scotland. Some of us perhaps would say, well, what did you expect? But what's most interesting is that Tony Blair, who's down in Mexico still and hasn't come home for all this, apparently Reid rang him yesterday, and Mr. Adams said on television last night that in fact Blair assured them less than a month ago at the talks in the British Midlands, if you'll recall, that in fact he wouldn't allow the institutions to be abolished again. So he's gone back in his word again, and where have we heard that story again? I want to make two other points with regard to the Southern involvement in this, and of course the theory is that this peace process is a joint Dublin-London adventure, that both sides are trying to work in cooperation with the American State Department to get the natives to behave themselves in the north and so on. Well, two things that occurred yesterday that gets my back up very definitely, and I'm sure some of my fellow countrymen in America. One was, of course, that the Secretary of State abolished the institutions, or he suspended them without, the phrase, by the way, the BBC are using is mothballed, but anyway, without consulting the Dublin government, essentially saying it was my decision, I did it, and I then informed the Dublin government. That doesn't appear to be very much of an equality agenda in my view, indeed even for the government in Dublin, never mind the Republican people in Belfast who are involved in the Stormont business. And secondly, of course, he then summoned the Irish Foreign Minister Brian Cowan, decent man, a good man, on holidays in Connemara, but living in Tullamore County, Offaly, to go to Stormont this morning to talk matters over and to try and persuade him as to why he should restore the institutions again. I would have argued, and indeed I know other people in Fianna Fáil who would have argued, that he shouldn't have gone, of course, to Belfast. He should have invited Mr. Reid to come down and account for his movements on the other side of the border. There's an old psychological thing in that, in the British approach to diplomacy, that they always make decisions and then they inform you and then they ask you to come over and talk about it. And we've seen that before as well. Can I go on to something else that's on the agenda over here at the moment? And there's been some items about it this morning. And if I may pick your memories. I don't know how many presenters in the studio this evening, one, two or three, get your thinking caps on. The first one I want to mention, and we'll come back to it next week, is a thing called Oracles of God, a book by Patrick Murray, which deals with relations between the politicians and the Catholic Church from 1922 to 1937. It's a massive and brilliant work, which, amongst other things, mentions all the priests on both sides in the Civil War, which side they took, which bishops did this, that and the other. But the other story, of course, is that the arrangements are going ahead for the disinterring of the remains of Kevin Barry and the nine other Republicans who were hanged in Dublin in the period of the Black and Tan War. We still don't have a date for the actual state funerals there to be given, but probably about the 20th of September, which is the anniversary of Barry's arrest. But because of this, of course, song Kevin Barry, which was off the RT airways for something like 25 years, is back on the air again. It's amazing the way things progress after a Stalinist regime. And there are two versions that are being mentioned in the literature, as they say, apart from all the other ones, the Closing Time Republicans. One is the trumpet version by Eddie Calvert. Is he an American? He's silver trumpet. There are no words in that, you see, and that's useful. And the other one then is Paul Robeson. I think it's the one that WBAI uses.
Yeah, it is, Paul. It's a great version, and
Paul Robeson, if I may use the phrase politically correct, is a black American, but was also a communist sympathizer, so he's not very popular. And I'm going to ask your listeners out there for next week, and remind me about it, who used to have the version on the Waltons program? This is the old Waltons Musical Instruments sponsored program on Radio Éireann in the old days, saying, if you feel like singing, do sing an Irish song. Because the man who recorded it, in fact, died here about 10 days ago. I let that. But the other interesting thing, of course, is that in all the versions that I've heard, including what they had this morning on the radio, they omit the second verse. So we start in Mountjoy Jail one Monday morning, etc. He proudly held his head in high. Then they usually go on to just before he faced the hangman in his really prison cell. Can anybody sing me, anybody of the presenters in the studio, sing me the second verse?
No, we don't want to subject our listeners to that knowledge, please.
Well, then can I quote you the first two lines? And if anybody can fill in the other four, we'll give them what? A free record next week. It says, why not shoot me like a soldier, do not hang me like a dog? Does that stir a memory with anybody? Or was that removed from the American version too?
I fought to free Ireland.
Sorry?
Well, I am an Irish soldier, and I fought to free Ireland.
Very good. That's half marks. Yeah. Anyway, hopefully there will be some reaction to that. But has that verse been dropped from the popular version in America also?
I don't know, but when that comes up and when they had the ceremony in Dublin, we'll definitely get a couple of verses.
The only other thing I want to say about this, of course, is that the definitive book on Kevin Barry and the best one, pamphlet, was issued in 1955 by the Republican movement, introduction by General Tom Barry, and it was written by a guy called Sean Cronin, who is now living in retirement in Washington. So that's the way the world goes around.
Well, Nolik, we're going to go off. We'll leave you now.
That's your archive.
You can savor the Kerry victory, and we're going to now play Odetta singing The Foggy Dew. And I tell you, if you have tape recorders, tape this, because it's probably not often that you get to hear this version of The Foggy Dew.
Straight and true, nor the earth.